Hello, everybody, and welcome. This is Terry Patton, and we're here for this free teleseminar called An Integral Relationship with Your Soul. So let's begin just by joining together and dropping in a soulful way. So I want to invite you to take a moment to slow down. If you're at your computer or you're zooming around, it might be good to feel your body and ground through your feet and take a few deep breaths. Let's feelingly connect to ground and keep breathing and softening and opening and noticing the sky element and feel how we're feeling, just settling, noticing what's here. Pulsing rhythms of the heart, breath, body that's always pulsing, always connected to both ground and sky. Maybe we can sense that an incredibly sensitive instrument that's feeling so much, including a call beyond this life. So I'm going to attempt to share something that by its nature can't really fully be captured in words. And not only that, it's pretty deep and personal. And here I am speaking to a whole group of people, and I probably don't know everyone here. I can say I don't recognize all the names. And yet, what I want to talk about is something that can only be shared heart to heart. So I'm imagining something in terms of the connection here that is intimate, even though it's not based on knowing each other. And I'm going to share something that's very alive for me now. It's still unfolding. So what I'm sharing here is raw. It's a work in progress. You know, it's said that we teach what we need to learn, and even more ideally, what we are actively learning, because that's when it's really most honest and raw and potent and catalytic. So that's what I'm doing here. And I'm also going to share some important distinctions that are meaningful to me and that might be useful to some of you. And then I'll tell you about this integral soul work journey that I'm going to lead online and over the phone with a couple of small groups of people this year. I'm hoping to complete this seminar today in about an hour and a quarter, but we'll see how it goes. So the spirit of this whole investigation of soul work is native to us and in a way simple and natural. But it's really more profound than the minds with which we can talk about it or understand it. So I want to begin with some poetry, an excerpt from Rainer Maria Rilke's Book of Hours that evokes for me something of the spirit of what I'm talking about here. God speaks to each of us as he makes us, then walks with us silently out of the night. These are the words we dimly hear. You sent out beyond your recall. Go to the limits of your longing. Embody me. Flare up like a flame and make big shadows I can move in. Let everything happen to you. Beauty and terror, just keep going. No feeling is final. Don't let yourself lose me. Nearby is the country they call life. Know it by its seriousness. Give me your hand. So this process of living this process of keeping going with no feeling ever final, not letting ourselves lose track of whatever it was that God spoke to us as he made us. It's all work. And we're all already doing it in some way. It's not easy. There's a lot to bear in this process of being human. It's hard to be a person, especially in a world that's way out of balance, with human culture sharply displaced from the harmonies, even the partial harmonies that it once had, from the natural world out of which it evolved, being currently in crisis and exerting tremendous stress and sometimes terrible pain and injustice and even, you know, horrors on each of us and on all of us and other creatures. And with an amazing sense of transformational possibility, only a fraction of which it seems like we can realize in this lifetime, and sometimes this really hurts bad. And this pain, easily and universally, tends to translate itself into a generalized existential sense of separation and disconnection and problem and dilemma. Our inherent connectedness and wholeness, the true nature, truth of our real divine situation, is not a dilemma, it's not a problem. It never could be. But it so easily shows up in moment-to-moment experience, like we're in trouble, like we've got a problem. And from that place, everything you try to do to solve the problem, to heal the wound, to set right the imbalance, just acts out and reinforces that underlying belief in the reality of the problem. And then it subtly calls the problem into being. It functions as a self-fulfilling prophecy, this dilemma mind, self-fulfilling prophetic force of problem consciousness, holds us in a certain kind of participation in life and in which we're intuiting and trusting our connectedness in a different way. What is it like to participate in life trusting our connectedness, not in a problem, knowing that we are already connected to our soul nature and to life itself and to the inherent wholeness of things? When I'm really faithful to that, trusting of that, when I'm knowing through that connectedness that I can trust the process of my life, that I truly have personally been chosen by the mad affair of central casting for my particular role in the world, one that is valuable and honorable. And then instead of being a wannabe who underneath feels useless and meaningless, and begin to become somebody who's deeply tuning in to how my role is showing up for me and the patterns of my living right now, and I'm able to respond to whatever's appearing in my life in a way that is alive to that wholeness, and therefore making use of the opportunities that are presenting themselves in every moment. So I become able to notice what's right in front of me. So when I see it, I'm able to pick up the cathode with one hand and then reach for the anode with the other and let the force of life run through my body and complete its circuit. Oh, yeah. Here is an opportunity to participate, to help the greater thing that already wants to happen to actually happen. Thank you. That way of participating. You know, life is mystery to be lived, not a problem to be solved. So this word soul is used in a lot of ways to mean a lot of different things. And I am involved right now in a living process that's dynamically deepening and expanding my relationship with my soul and my sense of soul. So I'm not going to begin by trying to nail down a final definition, although later on in the presentation I will offer eventually five principles of integral soul work. But we all know what we mean when we use it colloquially. You know, when you say that that music has soul, or we call somebody a lost soul or an old soul, or we imagine an ideal soul mate, or when we say that that business or that town has no soul, or hear Bonnie Raitt sing, or Train's tenor sax, or quality of a meal cooked with love. We know what we mean when we feel and see soul. Certain places in the natural world. I feel like what's most real, the more generous than focusing at first on definitions, is that I'll just tell you a part of my story, my journey, and the process of how soul work has become so prominent for me in my life right now, and why I'm becoming so passionate about this, and why I'm offering this right now. I'll just speak my truth. And then I'm intending to talk about it more theoretically too, to, you know, help you understand how I see it in a larger context and set forth some of the insights and the Dharma that frames my understanding of it. Now, the first, some context. I think most of you already know this, but some may not. I teach integral spiritual practice, integral life practice, and I've been a pretty serious practitioner for over 40 years now. But what makes me able to catalyze transformation for others is not that I've achieved anything in particular, but just that I keep choosing to practice in the ways I understand it. That I know deeply how profoundly I need to practice. And like with anything else, my ways of practicing, you know, as you repeat them over time, you know, will tend to become habitual and a little automatic or unconscious and get grayed out. So I have to rediscover practice again. I have to wake up again and again. I have to really be willing to make a real rediscovery, to really experience revelation of something that wakes me up radically and changes my world. And I've learned to trust that process, to trust life, to trust myself, and to really go for broke, heart first. So I do have something to teach, but what I don't have is a formula for practice. Practice is really an art. You have to show up. And it's always a new, original act. It's a new discovery in each moment. And it's improv, it's alive, and it's never the same as it was before. So that's what I've been doing for some time now. But the chapter of my story I want to tell right now picks up just a little over a couple of years ago. And on the surface, I was already leading a really blessed existence and a pretty terrific life. But I'd begun getting these little intuitive messages that things were needing to make a pretty dramatic shift. And, you know, I was blessed to spend a lot of time in very deep, soulful, happy ways of being with real feeling depth. You know, I was touching into incredible peace and joy and happiness each morning when I would sit and do my practice. And I was redirecting my attention during the day very often, moment to moment, arriving in a sense of wonder at the mystery of existence. And I was able to spend extended time in nature, had time in solitude and in meditation, gathering purposefully with deep, soulful, and brilliant people all over the world. And I was getting in touch with very subtle, deeply ingrained habits of mind and emotion, though, that were stubborn and were holding me back and keeping me in an orbit that it was time to outgrow. So I was being called to find my way through some new portal. And I didn't really know how to do it. And in a way, you become a little bit of a prayer for you don't know what when you're in a moment like that. And so things began to change. I let go of certain kind of efforts that had been characterizing my life and work. And I developed a whole series of allergies to compromises I was making. It was a quality of stress and of pushing, efforting in my approach to work. I was becoming allergic to spending so much time on my computer. And this whole thing of marketing efforts and, well, any communication, you know, where there was an ulterior motive that wasn't up front. I was just got so allergic to that. I needed it all to kind of have a wholesomeness and honesty. And there were compromises that my wife and I had made in our relationship that I became allergic to also. It was during this time that our marriage of over a decade, and she's a really wonderful person, that came to an end. It got very raw, and I started listening to life, well, even before that, but altogether more and more, you know, at a deeper and deeper level. And I did something that I've done a number of times before over the years. You know, I just started paying attention now to yet another, even deeper level of subtle anxiety, you know, that had previously escaped my notice. Now, there's the obvious anxiety that we can feel, and I don't want to pretend I didn't have my share of that. I did for sure. But there are many subtler levels of anxiety, too. You know, I realized that there's a subtle anxiety that generates most of ordinary thinking. And a lot of my impulses to eat or entertain myself or even socialize with other people, reach out. Subtle anxiety, I think, is behind all strategic thinking. It's often present in even everyday planning, a lot of creativity, even humor. And that anxiety, because it rests on and reinforces some root beliefs that, you know, you're separate and alone, that you've just got to push or reach, that life is a struggle to survive. That's a really deeply rooted belief. And I began to realize that I just couldn't live on the basis of it anymore, even though it was patterning me. This subtle anxiety was just plain not my real truth. All my life, if I look back, I've led an amazingly blessed existence, almost never really under serious threat. The worst thing about my whole life in reality has been the anxiety that I've added to a blessed existence and the stress I've willingly chosen because I believed that anxiety. And so I realized that there was a deeper way of living. Instead of comparing myself to other people, which, you know, usually made me appear to be pretty deep and sincere and free, I began to pay more attention to what's really possible, which made me realize that a much more profoundly deep fidelity to my soul's signal was possible and that I had a long way to go. And I found that my life began to be all about one thing, letting go of anxiety, sometimes very, very extremely subtle traces of it, and the whole pattern of attention and feeling that comes out of that anxiety at deeper and deeper levels. A reorientation from the belief that my life is a struggle to survive to the knowledge that life is structured for me to thrive and to fulfill a purpose and to trust that, to really know that it's true. And so again and again, I found myself relaxing and reorienting my inner rudder, deeper way than ever before. And there was a layer of very subtle underlying, subtler beliefs and presumptions than those I'd already seen and let go of that I was seeing through, consciously outgrowing. And the more and more consistently I redirected my attention toward this embodied trust of this event, this life, or a deeper and deeper discovery of the profundity, the sanity, the truth, the gracefulness of this event, not something universal, something personal and particular, unique to me, my home, the blessedness I can really radically rest inside of. And this wasn't easy. My psychological typology is not inclined toward unconditional trust or ease or confidence. It seemed naive, like magical thinking, you know. But I was really seeing through this self-contraction at a whole new level, realizing that my anxieties, you know, they're habits, they're okay, but they're truly an illusory construction and amazingly costly. And as I made this choice again and again and again, many times a day, redirecting my heart disposition, choosing trust again and again, I began to have a new level of strength in some very important inner muscles. And I found myself able to listen much more fiercely for what I really cared about, you know, instead of listening for opportunities or possibilities, started listening not for what was more or less advantageous, not more or less interesting or more or less persuasive, but really only for one thing. What was really most deeply true for my soul? What was really aligned to what's deepest in my being? My reasons for being here. I stopped caring if somebody I met was famous or influential or well-connected or wealthy or could help me. And I began focusing on caring about how my inner sensor felt when I was with them. Did it feel really right, healthy, wholesome in this deep, soulful, almost tantric sense? Tantric in the sense of connecting opposites. If I felt attracted to a person, was I attracted from a place inside that was really deep and resonant and soulful and healthy, or from some place essentially hungry? A place inside that was rooted in some level of that subtle anxiety. So I found myself spending less time with people who could help me, focusing on projects that didn't earn money or seemingly advance my career, but doing what was most authentically alive and meaningful to my soul. And I found myself beginning to orient my teachings toward the topics that were most real and alive in my deep inner process. And after I'd been doing this pretty consistently for almost a year, I found myself feeling a spontaneous attraction to focus on soul work. And that wasn't new to me. I had focused on it a lot. I wrote the epilogue of the book Integral Life Practice, which is really all about soul work. And I'd taught it before to my students. I'd even led miniature Dawn Quest, Vision Quests. My friend Jonathan Gustin, following Bill Plotkin, calls it lower world practice because you go down into it. He distinguishes that from upper world spiritual practices that ascend into freedom. And I wrote a little about this to you in the email invitation that I sent that probably brought you to this call. So transcendental spiritual practice is about growing to higher states and stages of consciousness and eventually awakening, not just from limiting perspectives and identities and states of mind, but even from the illusion of our very separate individual existence. And as we awaken level by level, it feels like our consciousness and identity ascends and expands. And those of you who've taken my 8-session course in integral spiritual practice know that my background has come from this kind of spirituality, a radical awakening as consciousness and love. Now, my unique focus has been on integrating that transcendental spirituality with our embodied human experience, especially our feeling life. And I've emphasized and clarified an integral second-person spirituality, devotion, a love relationship with the divine, and the recognition that radical conscious awakening and being in love with God are not two different paths or principles, but really different dimensions of the same thing, that they culminate in something that includes the other, and ultimately they're facets of something single. And I've taught that practice involves noticing the countless little opportunities of every moment of living, and choices about our attitude and where we place our attention, and making good choices. And so my approach really has been alchemical and organic and embodied, not abstracted. It's been a tantric inquiry, not in the sense of sex, but integrating opposites. It's woven deeply into all my work. But I began to get interested in something I haven't emphasized as much. I don't want to put down transcendental spirituality. It's woven into the fabric of my being. But soul work is different. It's about the descent into our embodied and unique soul expression, most often vividly known through dreams, nature mysticism, depth psychotherapy, shamanic journeys. And you have to recognize a sacred mystery in your own being to do that. It's slow-moving, nature-connected, mysterious, and it reveals itself to us in the specific texture and flavor, the expressions of our unique purpose in life and our deeper reasons for being here. And I knew that some of the people, many of the people who teach from this soul-centric perspective hold that even this radical awakening and non-dual consciousness is actually a mistake, a sidetrack, not the right thing. But I see it differently. Integral philosophy is grounded in what's sometimes called panentheism or evolutionary panentheism. It's like pantheism sort of says that there are gods in everything you see. Panentheism is a big word that means that God is both immanent and transcendent. Everything is God. There's God in everything. There's only God, as my root guru, Adidasa Amraj, put it. And nothing in itself is God. God is beyond all forms and ideas and experiences and states of consciousness. Utterly, elusively transcendent, not identical to even the most supreme experience of love or light or bliss or clarity or enlightenment, means that God is radically paradoxical, means that every authentic perspective that can be taken on God is, as Ken himself has said, both true and partial, which means to me that even if there is a high awakening in which every trace of individuality might be transcended, it's also valid to frame the whole process of practice from a soul-centric perspective and look at it all as an aspect of the journey of the soul. That even the awakening beyond individuality is part of the journey of the soul. Which means that I became satisfied that integral soul work was not a deviation from anything in terms of the transcendental spirituality, but really an enrichment of integral practice. And I got very clear that even though, yes, as integral theory emphasizes, there's a clarity brought by a non-dual, radically, consciously awake perspective, and that that's hugely important. There are things that soul work gets at that are also absolutely essential and sorely underrepresented at this particular moment in the evolution of spiritual culture in the integral world that I teach in. But, there's a reason why it got de-emphasized in the first place, so I want to take a minute or so to explain something about that, because you got to realize that throughout spiritual history, 90% of human religion and spirituality is exoteric public religion for the masses that really didn't even have much going on. And the vast majority of esoteric spirituality has mostly been about subtle experience. So teachings on realizing radical consciousness and non-duality were the secret teachings that were only given after years of practice to the highest initiates. It's only been in the last 30 years or so that these radical teachings have become so popular and so influential in the West. In Tibetan, Zen, Theravadan, Buddhist schools, especially Dzogchen and Mahamudra, in Advaita Vedanta, in Ramana Maharshi, his students, Kunjiji, Adidasa Amraj, my teacher, even Ajahshanti, Eckhart Tolle, Byron Katie, certainly in Ken Wilber's integral philosophy. These radical dharmas are hugely influential. I saw it happen, though. It's all been relatively recently. It wasn't that long ago that the spiritual bookstore was called a metaphysical bookshop, and most of what was taught in there, what you found in those books, were about subtle experiences, cartographies of higher etheric, astral, and psychic planes, out-of-body experiences, clairvoyance, communication with the dead and disembodied spirits, archangels, subtle hierarchies like the Great White Brotherhood. And they were often mixed together with seances and mesmerism, astrology, tarot, numerology, conversations with spirit guides, and old-fashioned and new-fashioned versions of everything else that mainstream rationalists ridicule as New Age. And all of that was characterized as being about the journey of the soul. Now, I don't think all this stuff should be ridiculed or say it was all diluted, and I'm pretty sure that there were rich explorations among people engaging it, but it did have some pretty serious problems. It was very subject to, subjective factors, you know. Whole groups of intelligent people agreed about incredibly detailed and rich cartographies of subtle realms that were incommensurate with others. The channelings of one angel or somebody's angel Michael and somebody else's angel Michael, you know, didn't agree. The possible journeys of the human soul. And for instance, the many schisms that have divided theosophy are an illustrative point, you know. And the most famous one, Colonel Ledbetter, who had obviously remarkable subtle vision, he was able to recognize an extraordinary aura on this young boy, I don't know how old he was, 10 or 11, Jiddu Krishnamurti, and he said, oh my God, this is the world teacher, and they groomed him for that role, but then Krishnamurti grew up and said, wait a second, I'm going to think for myself, and I don't believe this cartography, and he renounced his role as the world teacher and rejected the whole philosophy. And there are four or five other huge schisms that divided theosophy. So this focus on the subtle had been criticized anciently in the highest teachings of Buddhism and Hinduism. They cautioned that all subtle perceptions and experiences needed to be recognized as non-ultimate, that they tended to be fascinating and that people would tend to get attached and they'd want to acquire those capacities and become clairvoyant or intuitively awakened. They'd want to see auras. They'd want to have these capacities and that would delude them. And all this talk of these realms certainly wasn't compatible with the modern rational mind. And so I think there's something hugely important of epochal cultural significance about the clarifying integration of science and spirit that's possible on the basis of a radical non-dual view, especially as that is embodied in integral philosophy and especially in Ken Wilber's approach. I should point out here, though, that ideas about non-duality are not the same as the amazing profundity of authentic non-dual spiritual realization. So the logical acceptability of a non-dual view to a scientific person is helpful in terms of it having cultural acceptance. But let's have a little bit of humility about what that is as a realization. And let's have a little humility about the subtle realities, because although they are non-ultimate and they do easily become a source of confusion, and you can't ground a fully integrative philosophy on anything short of radical non-dual consciousness and love, what's called Sat-Chit-Ananda, those experiences of subtle awakening and subtle capacity are real potentials of human beings. And they've tended not to be embraced or emphasized in the integral, but even in the non-dual spiritual worlds. So this is a both and with some nuances. I want to focus today on soul work. I am still satisfied that the perfectly still and silent, moveless consciousness is, you know, Shiva, the senior principle, and the moving energy, intuitive awakening, Shakti, is the junior principle. Now, they're locked in eternal embrace. They're not ultimately separate. But in the normal path of purification, where you just a knot, one set of fixations after another, you get out of the gross fixations, you get to the subtle, and then you get to the causal, and then you get to the non-dual. The causal dimensions are more profound. The full non-dual realization is radically profound. Now, like any important true insight, though, that's going to make its way into culture, a bright line, a clear distinction needed to be made, and that's what Ken Wilber has done so effectively. And my root guru, Adi Da, did this before Ken, following the high dharmas of Buddhism and Vedanta millennia ago. So what they're pointing out is this focus on the soul and its journey is often experienced through the refinement of subtle awareness. And just as there's no end to the samsara of gross experience, there's no end to the samsara of subtle experiences. So the paths are always telling people not to become fascinated with bliss or light or not in ordinary capacities or charisma, and to notice the awareness in which it's all arising. Realize that, who you really are. So the virtue of drawing this bright line is that it is clear, it can be understood, and it has influenced culture mostly in really positive, necessary, important ways. But the downside is, like any map, it's simplifying a more complex reality and sometimes blurs important nuances. And so there have been some things that needed correction. And I was able to participate in the first big correction, which was a kind of a de-emphasis of devotion. And Ken saw this, and he offered this distinction of these perspectives, which he called the 3-2-1 of God. And it was a real privilege to be involved in those early discussions, and I was able to name it, the three faces of God, which is, I think, the name most people use these days. And now I think that there's another equally important refinement of integral practice, which is that the richer inclusion of soul work and the soulful modes of practice, which doesn't contradict integral theory, is necessary. That even though consciousness is the senior and radical principle, we are also equally energy. And as we grow into our total human potentials, the discovery of our soul's nature and shape becomes important. The awakening of our awareness of our subtle bodies, our subtle information fields, our higher intuitive and subtle capacities, these are real and important dimensions of human capacity. So soul work needs a major new emphasis now, to a degree that it never had before in integral practice, even in the way that I've taught it. So it's important for integral practice to acknowledge and welcome a very rich and deeply embodied, deep feminine principle of descent that is the essential spirit of soul work. Because with that not explicit, this impulse to go down and feel and trust in the nonlinear ways that characterize soul work can easily be suppressed, and then there's a lot of energy wasted trying to liberate the soul from what seems to be the hyper-masculine tyranny of transcendental spirituality. And then you've got the critique of the subtle by the transcendental and the critique of the hyper-masculine transcendental by the, there's a deeper unity, though, that holds both poles. Now, I have a lot more to say to clarify how this fits together at another time, but going back to my story, what I just want to say is that with all that understanding under my belt, I just dived into soul work, because at that point I really sensed that my deeper life depended on it. There was a call from my soul, so I was really listening. And I was revisiting the soul work literature as I knew it, going down. And there's another tradition of soul work that has to do with awakening into higher subtle light and intuition above. I taught a year-long program with Thomas Hubel that has more of that quality. I explored both these directions quite a lot in the last 2 years. But the emphasis that I'm speaking about today and the focus that's really been richest for me has been about going down. And in that process, one of the things that I did was I invited Sarah Beek, onto my online teleseries, teleseminar series, Beyond Awakening, The Future of Spiritual Practice. She had written a book called Red Hot and Holy, A Heretic's Love Story, and I'd met her socially and I'd looked at it. What happened in that dialogue was really helpful because Sarah described, you know, she's got a very colorful, vivid, intense journey. Wild and sexy and really quite different from my own experience in many ways, but she was certainly trusting the voice of her soul, just as I had been. And most important, she was emphasizing a particular take on soul work, which is that it's about a love relationship with your soul. And she said this in an authentic and powerful and clear way that I'd never heard quite in that way before, even in the rich descriptions of soul encounter that I was already familiar with. So she was making an important original contribution here, you know, specifying that it's all about this relationship, about recognizing a sacred being who is your own deeper divine nature and entering into a more profound and faithful relationship with that one and submitting to your soul's wisdom and guidance, even when that might seem really fierce or tyrannical and crazy. And this is not easy. Sarah's soul had insisted that she dump her boyfriend, break her book contract, fire her editor, jettison her then fast-rising career. And so her relationship with her soul was very passionate and fiery and dramatic. And although certain of the particulars of her story didn't feel like they were mine, there was something deeply authentic and resonant in her voice, something really moving. And I knew I needed to listen to something here very carefully. So in the interview, I asked her, so if there's something that our listeners are resonating with and yet they don't feel they have this experience, how can they do this? And she said very simply and sweetly, well, why don't you invite your soul to turn up the volume? And that really set it for me. It resonated as deeply true and appropriate that in some sense there was a relationship here that I was already attentive to, and I needed to turn to face my soul in that second person way. So, you know, just in recognizing the appropriateness of it, I found myself beginning to do that in a really deep way that wasn't strategic. It didn't come from my mind, my goal-oriented mind, from a much deeper place. So I found myself discovering out of that an authentic way to trust even more deeply. In a sense, this isn't about saying something in time and space. It's just like the heart, the being, the depths of the being, just sincerely opening and asking your soul, please, this is vital. I need this. I need this more than anything. Please turn up the volume so I can hear you. Really align my whole life with you. Now, it's kind of funny. The message I got back almost immediately was, okay, and meanwhile, turn up your hearing aid. You know, kind of emphasizing that it's all about 100% personal responsibility. And, of course, that hearing aid is in the heart, really. And this was totally different from awakening as love and consciousness into a sense of unity with all things, even though there is a sense of wonder and mystery here and there, too. You know, I realized that all the anxiety I'd been relaxing had really been an expression of a kind of trauma, a trauma to my soul. That, you know, very, very early, as a young boy, I'd existentially despaired of a truly warm and sacred connectedness with the soulful sacredness of my being, that I felt at the depths of my being, but somehow life didn't seem to support it. And in the deep inner places where that had felt so deeply horrible and terrifying something in me had become desperate, and that desperation, that disconnection became global and total, existential, and therefore is invisible to me as water is to a fish. So my practice had been, well, where is happiness? Where is something truly joyful? And it was through transcendental spiritual practice that I discovered that I could transcend this sense of separation and dilemma. And that was how, for the first time in my life, I really had discovered 100% freedom, happiness, joy, love. And that complete transcending of my limited identity and belief and feeling had, you know, thank goodness it had saved my life, and practicing in that way was a soulful gesture. But now I was discovering something that wasn't about transcending separation and trauma and seeking. It was about the embodied transformation of it, meeting it, being it, and living through a healing in a more organic and embodied way than I had thought was possible. But not something I could do. It's more like this faithful connectedness to my already soul relationship. And it was an extension of that process of trusting I'd already been doing, but I was beginning to open into something or touch something, you know, to be touched by something indescribably sacred and paradoxically, you know, it was deeply, deeply personal and also, you know, transcendentally wonderful, you know, more deeply me than most of my daily life and consciousness. And I began to feel like I had a love relationship with somebody who I'd always known but had never met, and that I had a divine date with this beloved one, a kind of destiny, an appointment, and that this is already healing that deep soul trauma. And I was setting in motion a much more deeply embodied healing. And at the time, I was working with a group of people in this, and I remember writing to them. I felt a little like a young girl first daring to hope for true love. You know, it was so tender and moving and wild. So what mainly began to unfold from there was the realization that it was, you know, I had to really prioritize this relationship, and then there's the discovery of how the voice of the soul would show up. You know, sometimes I could hear it very loudly in my heart, in my gut, in the form of an inner knowing that it, you know, something, a person, an activity, a scene, you know, was just like, no, doesn't feel right. And occasionally I heard a loud signal that something or somebody was really where I needed to go, was really right. But often what I felt was more subtle and more elusive and not so easy. So, you know, I began to notice, I kind of made a wrong move there. And it was like by honing that sensing, paying attention at a subtler and deeper level of my being. It really had begun to hurt when I lost track of that soul attunement and when it became vague or indistinct. It was just a profound intensification of this process of noticing, always more and more finely what really, truly feels most deeply right and resonant and what feels kind of off. My soul suddenly had me on a very short leash. My heart was opening to myself and my inner life was deepening in a way that really left no doubt. Now, there's been kind of some crescendos since then, but some things have really characterized things more stably. Like, I just can't respond to life from these superficial levels of my being. You know, what really matters is how true, how present, how deeply I'm being, I'm living. It's like zooming in, you know, like those amazing videos that go from, you know, 13 billion light years away down to Earth and then to a super magnified image of a person and then skin or, you know, a cell and then all the way down to atoms and molecules, atoms and subatomic particles. You know, it's like things that from a distance it seemed like they were right at the center of the bullseye of what was true, you know, suddenly are revealed as being, no, that's not the center. The center is, and as it's like I've been zooming in more and more and realizing that I really, really have to aim for the very center of the bullseye. I can't get away with anything but kind of a constant process of correcting, and it's actually quite vulnerable and raw. I'm softer and tenderer in this, and in another way, though, a little bit stronger, or, you know, unable, unwilling to compromise in certain ways. I kind of know my ground more, and I'm listening much more sensitively, tuning in, I think, to deeper and deeper levels of what I feel like. There's something about being much more curious about the qualities of what's showing up on the scope of my feeling life with a lot of humility. And it's a soulful sensing, not from the head center as much as the heart and gut, although including the head, of course. I'm just really curious about the many levels of how I'm experiencing everybody, every event. You know, it makes me better able to pay attention, to notice much more, and tuning in, you know, to where life's richest gifts are really coming from. And recognizing that the stuff that really is valuable, you know, those are gifts. You know, I've been learning to trust that life's invitations and openings are coming, and I can wait for them. I don't have to be afraid they won't come. And in that, it's not a matter of being passive. You know, sometimes it's about, you know, you got to hit it. Yeah, sometimes you have to work hard, seize the moment. But it's really pretty much shifted, strategic, motivated effort. Because it's about discerning between the deep and organic and the forced and superficial. So I'm turning into slower, deeper rhythms of life and of the soul. And I'm still intensely active, but I'm coming from a place in which I'm really trusting life and taking the time it takes to really metabolize my experiences. So I'm not responding quite as quickly sometimes, letting myself metabolize things before I respond, not responding just from the head's intuitive centers, but from the whole embodied being. This kind of sensing is something, there's this nice quote from John Keats, the romantic poet. He says, "I'm certain of nothing but the holiness of the heart's affections. And the truth of the imagination, the holiness of the heart's affections." So recently I've been discovering that living, you know, more and more in this faithful, loving communion in relationship to the unique essence and flavor and intentionality of my own deeper soul nature, the dance of energy and consciousness in my life has sometimes really come together in a nearly magical way. Like it becomes coherent and kind of magnetic. And this is can be amazingly powerful. It kind of inverts the normal dynamics that are more rooted in the superficial levels of energy and identity. And this subtle fear-based stuff is kind of poison to it. But when this has happened really clearly and powerfully, you know, wow, it seems to have activated kind of a psychophysical field of attraction in which life has conspired to orchestrate blessings in support of the fuller incarnation of my soul nature and the actualization of my purpose for being here on the planet more and more. There's some stories I could tell, but I'm going on quite long already, so simply I'll say I've been amazed by the synchronicities, the textures, the blessings, the good luck that I seem to have magnetized during the most intense periods of alignment. Now, you know, this also shortens the leash and has really kept my feet in the fire. So it isn't just an idealized wonder sweet Jesus, you know, everything's good. It's just intensification of the passionate adventure. It's a lot of blessings, but there's more at stake, you know, and in a way, there's no rest for the weary. There's more blessedness, more beatitude, but there's also more demand. But I feel uplifted and sublimed and a more free and creative and humorous possibility comes in. And then it needs to be regained. I have to keep practicing, no question about it. And, you know, the magic piece here can be a little bit deluding because then my experience is, oh, wow, that felt great. I want to get back to that. And then the trying to get the effect becomes another strategy, right? And it's the thing that messes it up. So it ruins everything. And even if you do it only a little tiny bit, you know, it's really your load of lower motives, you know, for the goodies just corrupt the whole purity of everything. So it just, you know, it doesn't work, or if it does sort of work, you know, it doesn't last and it costs more than it's worth. So it's still an artful, you know, it's a romance, it's a dance, and yet most of the problems that are bringing people to spiritual practice, you know, the life issues with purpose and career and money and love and happiness are effectively addressed in some ways even more directly by soul work than spiritual work. I think ultimately they're a partnership, but I think that that's why the history of spirituality has been dominated by these subtle awareness techniques and mastery, you know, magic, really. But it's my experience that soul work in our time, if, you know, the awareness that we have is really something we can only get these benefits from in an unconditional mode with a really pure and open heart. So I think that it's really important for integral practitioners now, this kind of soul work, and there are so many different inner processes that are called soul work. I've done a bunch of research and even more leading up to this call, and I think I should say something more about what I'm calling integral soul work, you know, what distinguishes it from conventional soul work. So this is kind of provisional. I'm still investigating it, so I'm not putting this forward like a declaration. I'm not an expert. I'm on the path. But I think I'm getting out ahead of some important distinctions that will probably be useful to many people. So let me set them forth. There are a few here. One of them is the both and principle, you know, that an integral approach to soul work relates to this descending work and the ascending work of transcendental spirituality in the spirit of both and rather than either or. Even though most teachers of soul work and of transcendental spirituality are tending to say, hey, the other is missing something and this is the highest truth or the most important thing, and the other does violence to it. Now, there are good reasons and even deep truths for those orientations, and there's a lot to be learned from people who are seeing it in that either-or way. I'm not putting value on either side of this, but and I think even in our lives, there are times when we may need to embrace one of these principles especially, and it may be a time of liberating ourselves from the way in which the other has pressed on us in a tyrannical way. But I think in the end, there's a place to stand where they're both clearly true and important, and each is actually raised up and uplifted and ennobled by your openness to the presence of the other principle. So I feel clear that for me, integral life practice continues to be my path, and it's expanded and strengthened by integral soul work. Soul work's not an alternative but an enrichment. Now, the second principle is soul as process. That is, a lot of the literature on soul reifies and defines soul, and ideas about soul itself or one's own soul. I think an integral soul work relates to soul as a paradoxical living process. So it focuses on the moment-to-moment practice of soul work in the form, you know, of trusting and listening to and conforming yourself to your soul's priorities and clarities. But you know, this idea, though, that the soul is not so much the entity as the process, that almost misidentifies it, because it's kind of, you know, like light is both a wave and a particle, a wavicle. I think that soul is both a process and an entity. You know, it's translucent. The entity way that it shows up needs to be taken seriously and not be letting off the hook by making your relationship to your soul. Well, the soul's not really an entity, it's a process, so you make it theoretical and fuzzy. No, it's more resonantly present and formidable, but also translucent. You know, the soul as process, I think, is a liberated and deeper way of holding it. A third principle of integral soul work is that it embraces and opens into, you know, what Sarah emphasized, this living second person love relationship with the deeper pull of your unique soul nature. And it trusts this love and devotion. And then the grace that comes from it to be the real power emanating and animating your whole process. So it's not a goal-oriented effort, you know. It's a rich, all-consuming romance, a heroine's journey. And then the fourth principle is that integral soul work is organic and embodied. It's about dropping down into your relationship with yourself and the planet, the natural world, and what is already real and alive and moving and changing and hurting and dying and what is needing to happen. So it's deeply related to what's sometimes called the deep feminine, the dark goddess, the non-linear feeling depths of the psyche. And then the fifth principle is that it says yes and, instead of yes but, to the subtle. You know, without idealizing subtle experience and while honoring the radical nature of non-dual awareness, it really opens a path for growing in our conscious, artful relationship to the subtle and to a more conscious and skillful relationship to the magical psychophysics of life's dynamics. You know, including learning to surf and serve subtle fields and information and energies and experiences. So the actualization of your full subtle capacities is another dimension of integral soul work. So what that means in practice, I think, is that just like integral life practice, it's post-metaphysical. You know, that is, it focuses on, you know, do this and this happens. It focuses on the living practice, the injunctions, rather than ideas or claims about it all. And so these are really powerful and attractive things that can come out of soul work. And it really is a way to genuinely bring about a lot of the things that are most important to most of us, the kind of stuff that's promised in, alas, way too much marketing copy. A lot of the spiritual marketplace is about aspects of soul work, but of course, when, you know, the marketing copy kind of turns it into a goal, which spoils it. But this is the done with a pure heart and without a goal orientation. This really is the process by which you can awaken to your life's purpose. It's how you can align with your soul. It's how you can let your soul orchestrate the changes you really want in your life. It's how you can attract the kind of relationships you really want. But all of that only happens on its own schedule, only as a side effect of soul work that's done for its own sake, you know, for love, with an open and pure heart, you know, without craving and strategic ulterior motives. dominating. Sure, they creep in, but you know, the practice is to reorient. So I'd say, you know, soul work is not, you know, a way to win. It's a way to be true and deep, sacred, and that brings blessings.